This February, Jackson Lucas celebrates Black History Month on the Beyond the Resume podcast by revisiting some of our best interviews. These African-American leaders, pioneers, and industry titans have inspiring stories that hold tremendous value to this day. On behalf of all of us at Beyond the Resume, we hope you enjoyed these throwbacks. Thank you for listening.
All right, folks, I am your host, Chris Papa, and today we have a very special guest, Mr. Dudley Benoit. Dudley is the Executive Vice President at Alliant Capital and based in Los Angeles, California. How are you, Dudley?
I'm good, Chris. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me and making the time. Appreciate it.
I think if I remember correctly, you're from New Jersey, right?
Yeah, born in Newark, New Jersey. Lived like the last 25, 26 years in Jersey City before moving over to LA almost 2 years ago.
Did you, as a fellow New Jersey native and California transplant, did you have some sort of, I remember thinking about LA and thinking, oh, LA, how could I ever live in LA? And then when I actually went there, I was like, whoa, I know why I can live in LA.
It's funny, when I was in graduate school, several of my good friends, all LA natives, and I spent in it for work. I worked at JP Morgan and other places. So I spent a fair amount of time in LA. And I always thought it was the last place on earth I ever wanted to live. You know, like I live anywhere else but LA. But quite frankly, this point in my life with kids and space, and not a bad place to live in the pandemic if you could, you know, be outside a year round and stuff. So we've taken to it. The kids like it. The wife likes it. So we're good. We're good with it.
Nice. Yeah, I like LA a lot too. I'm actually going to be down there this weekend.
All right.
My best buddy lives down there. Well, cool. Could you just tell the audience what is Alliant Capital? So, what do you guys do?
Yeah, Alliant Capital is a privately owned low-income housing tax credit syndicator. That's a fancy way of saying we're essentially a real estate private equity fund that focuses on development and financing of rental affordable housing. For those that don't know, the low-income housing tax credit is the primary vehicle that is used to build multifamily rental affordable housing in the country. And we've been at it for a little over 23 years. We have a nice practice, and I've been with the organization probably a little over 2.5 years. And right now, we've probably done projects in almost every state in the union. I think maybe Maine is the one that we haven't done yet. But, you know, we obviously a big focus for us is in California, because that's where we've always been headquarters. But, we have over $8 billion in equity raised, about over $15 billion in assets under management since our inception. So, you know, we're good with this, and we like the space, and it's a great, you know, it's a place where you can do well and do good at the same time, because there's a shortage of affordable housing, and it helps stabilize communities.
Do well and do good. I like that. $8 billion of equity raised. Where does the equity come from?
Our investors are primarily finance banks and life companies, insurance companies. There is something called the Community Reinvestment Act, where, for make it simplified, it's an anti-redlining law that's been on the books for a long time for banks. And banks have to invest and lend in the communities that they serve. And the low-income housing tax credit is the primary way that banks fulfill that obligation, is by investing in low-income housing tax credits. And then secondly, insurance companies are a big investor in the product as well, because obviously life companies have a long, long tenure, long maturity of their investments. They need to be able to invest their premiums and the like for a long time. And on a risk-adjusted basis, the low-income housing tax credit program is probably the best and safest investment out there. If you look at over the 30-plus years of the program, the losses or foreclosures have probably been in a range of 40 bips or 450 bips, something like that. I'm not quoting the exact number, but there's nothing comparable for a 15-year product, and ours is a 15-year investment. Only thing that's comparable is treasuries. So, we can get a lot of the insurance companies have found it to be a nice place. And most of the groups that are doing kind of their fixed income look at LIHTC as a product that they like to invest in.
So these life cos or whatever, they invest with you, they allocate capital to you guys. And then Alliant goes out and buys the tax credits?
No, so
where do the tax credits come
from? Question.
They allocate.
So the each state does its own allocation of credits. So it's a national program, but every state does it their way. So there's a per capita given. So right now, I believe it's like $2.8125 per person. So whatever the population of your state, you get allocated $2.81 per person.
I think
the minimum today is for a state, don't quote me on this, I think it's 3 million. I could be wrong. I can't remember the number. But for really small states like a Delaware or something like that, there's a floor. But for the bigger, everyone else, is that 281 per head. And then you apply to a state for a 9% credit. And each state has priorities. One year, they may have a priority for, you know, seniors. Another may want to have priority giving you lead certification. I'm just making that up. But there's a point system, and then everyone applies. And the applications that score the best get awarded 9% credits. And there's also 4% credits that developers apply for that are as a right. So you use the bonding authority a state has, and you'll get a 4% credit that goes along with that. Obviously, the 9% credits provide you more credits than 4% by the name, obviously not by what's in the name, but that's kind of how the program works. So a developer goes out and applies for that. And then they win it, either a 9% or 4%, and then they go to a syndicator like an Alliant, and they say, hey, we have this deal. We're looking for 90 cents for every dollar of credit. And then we go out and try to find, we'll bid on that and we'll find an investor either that wants that investment. And we do our funds two ways. We have proprietary funds, which are single investor funds, or we have multi-investor funds where we have, you know, 7 or 8 investors that may come in for $150 million, $200 million fund that may have 7, 8, 9, 10 properties in it.
Wow. Thanks for explaining that. And so you work on both the 9% and 4%
yes.
credits in both arenas?
Yes. Yep.
It's awesome. And then Alliant, I mean, I don't know Alliant that well. I mean, I know the name. I've never worked with you guys, but are you, how large are you? I mean, how many people are there?
So we're primarily based here in Woodland Hills, California. We have right now, I believe, like 108 employees, something like that. I know we're hiring some more folks. And most of our employees are here, but we have some folks for asset management scattered out in different parts of the country. So, you know, we're not a huge organization, but, you know, we're not tiny either.
Gotcha. And then your role as an EVP, what is that?
So I manage the front end of the business. So I manage the team, the investor relations team. So they go out there, the team that's going out and getting the capital. And I also manage the originations team. That's the team that goes out and finds the actual transactions. So Drew Foster runs investor relations for me, and Jen Erickson runs our origination. So her and her team go out there, and when the developer wins a project, he comes to her and her team, and we bid on it to try to bring it in. And I also manage the marketing as well, and that's how you met Aaron and Amanda as well.
Nice. And so you have to know, I mean, it's your job to go out and know, we got to know the product, right? And then go out and kind of know the different type of investors out there and who might be looking for to invest in these type of products.
Exactly. You want to know, it's not just the investors, because it's part of it's a relatively, given what most people think about investment, it's a relatively small universe because it's mainly banks and insurance companies. Every once in a while, someone else, I mean, yeah. What we're seeing now is some of the healthcare companies are coming in, because it's been a clear acknowledgement that having stable, safe, affordable housing is a big contributing factor to being healthy as well. So we're seeing the CVSs and the Humanas and the Aetnas come in as well. But it's primarily banks and insurance companies. So the universe is relatively small, but you just want to know the pressure points, what investors are looking for, what their hot buttons are, and that changes sometimes with the economy and what the risk profile may be. So that's a big thing. Just always want to be in front of them and knowing what they want and where they want it, because the CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, is dependent on locations, right? So a bank that's headquartered in St. Louis probably has a lot of St. Louis CRA needs, so you want to make sure you can help them fill that need. A bank in Florida may need a lot in Miami, so you're also trying to stay on top of that and understand what they need. And on the developer side, you know, there's a lot of developers out there that are doing this. Some are new to this. Some of them have been doing it forever. And you just want to know who's out there, who has a good track record, who has good financial strength, who really understands the communities they're working with, and who understands all the ins and outs of developing real estate, right? You know, and especially today, where there's so many things that are going kind of sideways, whether it be lumber prices or sheetrock and stuff, you definitely want to focus on folks that know the process, have good financial wherewithal, know how to bid out a project properly, things of that nature. So you're taking all that into account. So my team on both sides, the investor relations and originations, they're constantly out there and they have to kind of have their ear to the ground and understanding what's going on out there all the time.
Gotcha. And did you start out in originations?
No.
And you kind of understood this?
I started out, I have a relatively different path, kind of came backward into this. I started out, again, I was always interested in urban areas, urban development, being from the Newark area, went to Rutgers for undergrad and assumed I was going to go to law school. So, you know, I avoided math like the plague. I was a poli sci major. I just stayed up, partied, stayed up late at night, wrote papers, and I was good for it. But I got towards the end of my college career, got introduced to this field of public policy by one of my mentors. Uh-huh. And then went to do a summer program at Cal Berkeley, at the Cal Berkeley School of Public Policy. And its program at the time was a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. And if you completed the summer fellowship well, and they recommended you, you can get a fellowship to go to graduate school for public policy. So I went to University of Michigan for public policy, did that. And my first job out of that was at a place called MDRC, which is a social research company. They did a lot of stuff on labor and employment and all that stuff. And it wasn't my cup of tea. So I kind of went to the bank and got in that, you know, this is an entry level analyst in the community development shop, which was then Chase Bank. So that's probably like 8 or 9 mergers ago, 10 mergers ago. Like,
Chase Bank, what's that?
Yeah, so that was a long time ago. And stayed at the bank for the most part for about 16 years and raised through, rose through various things, doing all kinds of stuff. And even did commercial real estate my last few years there on the multifamily side and got out of community development. But I landed up here because I banked Allied Capital when I was at JP Morgan. And when I left JP Morgan, I went to Santander Bank and helped them restart their community development practice. And I also invested with them there. So when there was an opportunity for Sean, who was the owner of Reliant Capital, Sean Horowitz, to bring someone in to help him manage the company, reached out to me, we talked about it, and I felt it was like a great opportunity. And my wife agreed, which is the way we could have done. It's a great opportunity, and we picked up the kids and moved across the country. And it's been a great decision.
That's great. And so what's the type of, like, if somebody was looking to be an originator or kind of more the investor relations side, like, what sort of skill set should they acquire in order to be successful in those career paths?
Facility with numbers, understanding accounting, and the biggest piece of it is sales, having that sales culture and having that sales mindset, right? Especially on the originator side, because originators in most shops, in most places, you know, most of your compensation is on killing what you eat, right? So you want to go out there, and the more you do, the more you can make, and you got to be able to establish relationships, and you got to really have a sales culture and a client focus. And being quite frank, not everyone does. Not everyone is interested in having their comp tied to success like that. So you have to have that kind of attitude and that get-go spirit to be on that. In the investor relations side, it's not necessarily that same level, but it's still a sales culture. You're in front of clients. You got to be out there. You got to get to know them, know what their needs are, understand their pressure points internally. You got to understand because every institution has, as an industry, we, I think, generally speaking, look at things somewhat similarly, but every institution may have certain things that they like more than not, or they don't like the other. And so you got to understand that. So it's still a sales culture as well, but I'm in finance, obviously in real estate. It's math, so a facility with numbers, modeling, Excel, accounting, all that.
So you tried to avoid
math? I tried to avoid it like the plague, and then I'd go, and then I was at the bank, they sent me to business school. So I really, I went to Michigan for policy school, which kicked my butt because that was nothing but math, and then later on going to business school. So as much as I try to avoid it, that's all I really deal with is numbers these days.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I went to Rutgers as well. Probably the best school in America.
Are you?
I mean, look at us. Look at us. But I avoided the business school component because I don't have to deal with that much math in my role. But I always wanted to learn that skill set. I mean, is that something you definitely would advise someone who went maybe to undergrad and a liberal arts major who wanted to get into this type of world, like at least somehow get some financial skill set?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do it. I don't know that you need to go back to graduate school per se. I mean, a lot of my mentors, a lot of people I dealt with in my career, they were maybe business undergrads or they worked someplace and they learned most of the stuff you're going to learn on the job anyway. No matter what degree you have, you're going to go to some company, whether big or small, they're going to teach you the way that they do it, right? So I do encourage folks to have a facility with numbers and not to be uncomfortable with it. So if you weren't a business major, you may have to figure out something, some way to supplement that so you can understand accounting and finance and all that stuff. But I don't know that for everyone it makes sense to go back to school unless you have larger goals, because there's obviously costs associated with that. So you're going to go back and take on a bunch of debt. Are you going to get a return? I hate to sound so like investment oriented about that, but I think the cost of graduate school and business school is significant. So
yeah,
if you're going to go back and do that, you should, you know, I always tell folks, if you're going to come out of business school and essentially do the same thing you're doing now and making the same amount of money you're making now, it's probably not that good an idea necessarily. If you're trying to look to make a significant career change, like you're an engineer and you want to go work on Wall Street, it's probably hard to make that transition. Going back to business school for a few years allows you to do that. So I think you just got to think strategically about whether that makes sense for you.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I did that. I did that math in my head. I was like, I don't think we're working. So do you get to experience like the projects that you're investing in with these developers, like kind of from start to finish sometimes? Are you able to like, are you guys involved?
Yeah, we
are. And you're kind of you're investing in it, but then are you involved with the process from the end?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of unique in this space because we have our own construction management team. So some entities contract all that out, but we really do. So we close it. We manage the whole construction process, and we're looking at the reports and we're looking at the draws internally. A lot of other syndicators have a separate, you know, they do third parties. And sometimes, depending on the investor, there may be a third party that we work with, but we're really doing that. We're going out to see them. I mean, obviously the pandemic, we kind of had to call Audible. We've been using FaceTime a lot to do a lot of that stuff, but thankfully we're going to start getting back on the road and seeing the projects ourselves. But that's one of the things we really like, because we do have our own construction team that kind of sees the whole process through. And then from there, we have our asset management team that's seeing the project throughout its life. And we have periodic reviews and making sure that we get out to see X number of projects every year.
It's got to be pretty rewarding to, you know, see a property or development site prior and then having, you know, being able to show up there and have it open a new property with all the tenants in place and all that kind of stuff. Are there any particular projects that you've kind of worked on that have kind of stood out for you?
I think it is great. The groundbreakings and things of that nature really give you a lot of pride and help you, you know, kind of, because some days you're just on, you know, you're on conference calls all day, you're just plowing through spreadsheets, things, and you don't necessarily always see the forest for the tree, but it is the grand openings, the groundbreakings, or you have ribbon cuttings and elected officials come out and, you know, you really see that you're making an impact on these communities. So that stuff is pretty great.
You said you might be able to go to law school when you came out of undergrad. Did you have an interest in housing?
No, that's the funny thing. I just had an interest in urban development and urban areas. So once I had my very first job out of grad school, I saw that wasn't a good fit. I was interested in how money flowed into or didn't flow into communities. So I was like, oh, well, go work for a bank. At least you go figure that out. But I had no real understanding of how any of this stuff worked. I think part of, and you know, I'm a first generation kid, Haitian immigrants and all that stuff, you know, never did the whole America thing, none of that stuff. So for me, it was kind of like a lot of the things I, you know, I take for granted now, or probably my kids will take for granted, understanding how the world works and business works. I had really no knowledge of that. So just being a lawyer, you know, my mother could tell everyone that her son was a lawyer. That she can explain. All the other stuff.
Yeah.
She can explain. So I'll just go be a lawyer.
Exactly. No, I was thinking about being a lawyer too. I actually worked at a law firm. I took my LSATs. I was ready to go to law school, and thankfully, I worked at the law firm and realized what
this is not LA law. Yeah,
this is not a law and order. This is not LA law. Yeah, oh god, that's funny. LA law. Yeah, and But I did like the fact that, like, I worked in the real estate part of the law firm, and, like, I could see the finished product. We did, like, the first Whole Foods deal in New York, and I was like, whoa, that's pretty cool. So I was like, hey, how do I get closer to that? I don't want to do this other stuff. And so then you kind of, that's great, man. It's a great story. You're at Alliant Capital. You're running investor relations and originations. I mean, what are you seeing? I mean, you're at the front lines of affordable housing and investments. Like, what are you seeing out there right now? Is it as a recruiter, I've been noticing affordable housing over the last 2 years probably has picked up substantially as far as job orders and activity. What kind of trends are you seeing out there?
Well, it's the more demand for the product, I think. So this will be the second kind of recession, even though the pandemic recession is more of an artificial recession than the last one. But, you know, how do you judge a product, right? You judge it how it performs at the worst times. And you look at this pandemic and you look at 2008, 2007, and this product, the low-income housing multifamily product, has performed great, right? So folks are more and more drawn to it. It's not as volatile, even though folks think of, oh my God, you're servicing low-income housing. A lot of people think it's slums and things like that until they get to know the product and understand this is world-class building for communities. And it performs well, even for our portfolio, even through this pandemic, we were all concerned that, you know, things are going to go pretty sideways. And throughout it, we had probably like 94% economic occupancy throughout the cycle. We've already seen it getting back up now. So I think our last report, we were probably in the 97% economic occupancy for some of the stuff. So we see a lot of demand and a lot of folks that are probably more doing, you know, market rate stuff, little by little trying to dip their toe into this market. It's a more complex market because of the regulatory piece of it and understanding how to get in. Mm-hmm. But I think those folks that want to spend the time in it, they figure out, like, this is a good place to be.
So you're seeing a lot more market rate developers, investors get into the affordable space lately?
Right. Fine. So we see it more and more. I wouldn't say a lot, but we definitely see more coming over because they kind of realize, hey, this is a good steady stream of income and it's less volatile than doing the market rate stuff.
Hedge a little bit there. How is the new, Biden came in office, like how do different political regimes like affect the affordable housing?
Well, the one thing I'll say about to low-income housing tax credit, it's always been kind of a bipartisan product. I think it started under, if I remember correctly, started under the Reagan administration. And the industry has done a really good thing. All the trade organizations like the Affordable Housing Tax Credit Coalition and the like have been very deliberate in making sure whenever there's legislation, there's ever adjustments to the credit or just making sure that we're talking to both sides of the house and getting, you know, both sides to sponsor legislation. And I think even the most skeptical of folks, once they see a project open up in their community, it's real and they see the positive impact in their community. So it's not just something happening in New York or LA, it's happening here in Wyoming, it's happening here in Nebraska, my community, that you're able to get people to sign on. So I think generally speaking, it's done well, regardless of administration, regardless of the party of the administration. Clearly, it has a cost, right? So depending on how folks feel about how fiscally we want to be, if we have to pay, you know, things paid for up front and all that stuff, that will have an effect on it. But generally speaking, there's a few things that is the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, and there's a lot of things that the industry is looking to do to make sure that we can build more affordable housing. And I think we're going to be relatively successful in that as well because the product has been so successful over time and has had great bipartisan support. So we don't know how and when these things will happen, but I think because the way the industry has always been positioned itself, working with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, we'll be well positioned to get some things in whatever the next bills are going to be that address either the budget or things of that nature.
Why do you see, where do you see Alliant going over the next couple of years and just the industry in general going? Any predictions?
I don't have any grand predictions. I think the industry is going to grow a little bit because especially if we can get some of these improvements to the credit in some, you know, increase in the 9% credit, getting the bond, you know, being able to lower the bond requirement from 50% to 25% is going to give us the opportunity to do more. So that's all the, you know, because the need is almost, it can't be met. So I think that's what we're end up seeing because the demand continues to rise. And I think we're continuing to be, you know, more trying to get more sophisticated, more efficient in how we go about working in these communities and working on these projects. So I think, you know, I think that's the biggest issue. And obviously, hopefully in the Biden administration, the one thing I will say is they've probably been more supportive in increasing funding to HUD and increasing funding for a lot of the other programs that surround the tax credit program that provide subsidies. So obviously, as an industry, we're very supportive of that. And the more that does, the more, you know, easier it is to make these projects work.
Nice. Thank you. Well, it sounds like you got a big job there, a very, have a lot of responsibility, a lot rising on your shoulders.
I'm fortunate to work with great people, and they let me lead them because they're doing all the hard work. I'm just kind of trying to direct the ships in the right direction.
Well, are you ready for an even harder assignment? How about the hot eight? Oh! But these are the questions I ask all my guests. Any books you recommend, whether it's regarding affordable housing or business or life or anything that you want?
There are two books I'm reading right now, and I haven't finished either, but they interest me for a lot of reasons. One of them is a book called Lights Out. It's about the collapse of General Electric, GE. I find it an interesting book because it really talks about kind of groupthink. So I was in business school, and even when I was in my career in JP Morgan, GE, Capital, Jack Welch, and all those folks always kind of held up as a gold standard.
The
program was a gold standard, and they did everything right. When it turns out, they were kind of cooking the books the entire time. So that's interesting. And Jeff Immelt came through and tried to figure out how to fix that, and he kind of couldn't do that. So that part of the book is interesting as well, but I think it's also interesting in the danger of groupthink, right? The danger of just following along and accepting a narrative as is without doing the work to figure out what's going on. And I think obviously after GE and Enron and MCI, a lot of that stuff, that folks are definitely probably more, you know, attuned to looking at that, but not really. When you look at WeWork, from day one made really no sense, right?
They are leasing
space for a dollar and subletting it for 90 cents, right? I mean, I'm fine, but that was their business model, and the world loved them. And everyone, JP Morgan, everyone loved them.
Anyways, sorry.
So that's an interesting book that I'm in the middle of. And then the other one is a book called Cast by Isabella Wilkerson, which is about, she has an interesting theory about, obviously we're in this current state of social justice and things of that nature, but she's looking at race, not as race, but looking at caste systems and looking at India, looking at kind of the Nazi Germany and how that happened with the way they looked at caste and the extermination of millions of Jews, and then also in race in America. So kind of not looking at a mirror.
What's that one called? Caste?
Caste, C-A-S-T-E. Looking at Cass, Isabella Wilkerson. I think she got the Pulitzer for that one. And it's an interesting take on really looking at, and for me, that's an interesting one. So even when I taught my class, taught a couple of times at University of Michigan on public policy, on economic development, community development, one of my first readings I always gave folks were the Case for Reparations by Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? Not because I was trying to convince folks about reparations for African-Americans or Black folks, but it was just really trying to teach folks that we've gotten to this place in America by very deliberate decisions. Like, it wasn't just, oh my God, how do we get here? Very, very serious and significant policy decisions that were made over time that ended up where we are today. And I think Cass, in a lot of ways, talks about that and helps you look at what's the decisions that folks are made over time in this country that kind of reflect on how we look at folks in the upper class, lower class, and things of that nature. So those are two interesting reads.
Fascinating. I'm going to order that one on Amazon as soon as we get off this. Do you listen to any podcasts?
I listen probably to too many sports podcasts, but the main one I probably listen to. From time to time, I mean, I listen to Bomani Jones's podcast like almost religiously.
Yeah.
And then the other one I like to listen to, I'm trying to pull it up, is Gregory Porter has the musician, singer, he has a podcast that I listen to. And then Questlove Supreme, I listen to all the time.
Nice. What's your sport? What sports do you like?
Probably basketball. I mean, I follow all the major sports, but basketball is probably my main sport. I mean, I was a runner, a mediocre runner back in my day. Track and field is probably my first love, but no, you know, that's something we pay attention to in this country every 4 years during the Olympics.
Hard to follow.
Yeah, we don't follow it. But.
A Knicks fan?
Yes. Oddly enough, I am a child of the 70s. People are laughing at me. I've always been a Magic Johnson fan. So I've been a Lakers fan my whole life. So actually, I'm back where I need to be. So that makes sense. So that worked out by moving to LA.
Nice. Yeah, that's a good move. I grew up a Knicks fan, so not so. It's good year this year.
The resurgence. Knicks are doing it. They are doing
it. So I wish I could have a Nets allegiance, but we would just go to Nets games because we couldn't get into Knicks games.
It's exactly.
It's be like every other fan that went there. Yeah, it's Brendan Byrne Arena.
Exactly.
Here's an interesting question. What impact does your real estate have, or the real estate you work with have?
We think it has it's interesting. Yes, I think we have it has a foundational impact on these communities. I think it's really helped transform communities. And it's the foundation kind of helping these communities resurge and or stabilize. I like to think back when I first started out at the bank at Chase. I started at Chase as an analyst in 1997, I think. And this was a time in New York when New York still had a lot of, you know, you look at the Bronx and Harlem and all these places now that are just ridiculously priced and already good, but the city was, you know, trying to redevelop and literally giving nonprofits buildings for a dollar.
Now,
that's part of I think it was the NEP Neighborhood Entrepreneurs Program. It was a whole bunch of programs that were really incentivizing folks to build and rebuild these dilapidated properties, a lot of times empty lots. And that is what Harlem, you know, that led to Harlem being the Harlem it is today. Versus every, you know, a bodega on every corner. Now you have artisanal mayonnaise shops thing every corner now. But that was the birth of converting all that stuff. So I think the affordable housing we see is foundational to our communities and helping stabilize and grow them. And we need more of it so that the folks that were there when it was all bodegas can stay there and enjoy it. You know, so that's always the rub once it starts becoming better, you know,
better
amenities and things of that nature. Now, unfortunately, not everyone that was there for the bad times or the rougher or the tough times get to stay. So, you know, that's why we need more of this stuff and better zoning laws and less NIMBY so folks could grow and prosper as these communities grow and prosper as well.
We had somebody on the podcast who was on the 125th Street Development Corp. I think that's it, right? And he was talking about the change that made there. That was pretty cool. All right. Now, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
Step out more, take more chances. And in a lot of ways I did, because I was a young kid, you know, I was just running around, but even take more chances. I should have took more chances and bet on myself even more.
Yeah, I think that seems to be a theme in a lot of people, including myself, is we kind of live in fear. We don't really act out of fear instead of faith, you know, type of thing. And
I think younger folks these days, it's a different environment. Like when I'm still old enough that I was still in an environment where people still worked for their company for 30 years and stuff like
that.
Now that's, no one does that anymore. So it's less of that pressure, I think, that, you know, that younger folks have now than they did when we were growing up. So I think now, and I like it. I think kids, I mean, you're an employer, you would hope they have a little more allegiance to you because you don't want to train someone to see them leave a year later. But if you're starting your career and branching out, you know, you should really be making sure you learn. If you can't learn, if you're someplace you're not learning and growing, keep it moving. I know it's hard for employers to hear, and it's hard for me, because when it happens with us, we're like, oh, we just trained that woman, that man, and we're losing them. But you got to look at your career as stepping stones to the ultimate goal. So you got to try to learn and build your skills as much as you can.
Yeah, no, good answer. And now I am a recruiter. And so, I mean, a lot of people listen to this, I'm sure, interested in different types of careers in the world and affordable housing. What do you look for? I mean, I'm not going to hold you to this, but like, what do you look for as far as like when you're hiring people or working with partners? Is there any certain skill sets and or just qualities in general?
Honestly, I'm probably these days, I look more for the soft skills than the hard skills. Could generally speaking, you can see the resume, you can see where they went to school, kind of their job experience. You could generally speaking, tell whether they'll be able to do the job. And again, you're going to train them the way that your company does it, right? Everyone, we all do the same thing, but we have our own way of doing it. So then you're trying to, for me, I'm trying to figure out how do these folks interact with them? Can they lead? Can they take direction? So, you know, one thing to do, I think that I remember one of the guys I used to work with at JP Morgan, we did a lot. When we had candidates we really liked, we went to lunch with them. Honestly, just to see how they interacted. Because that tells you a lot. You know, it tells you a lot about the person, how they're going to behave in the team setting and all that stuff. So for me, I'm trying to get signals on the soft skills because the hard skills, the all that stuff, you know, most of the people you're going to see at this point are smart and they can figure that out. But how are they going to work? How do they take direction? How do they interact with the team? That's really the important piece.
Great answer. Well, Dudley Benoit, Executive Vice President at Alliant Capital, thank you for your time. That was awesome.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. We're grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com.